Hello and welcome to the Unbundled Attorney Mastermind Podcast. My name is Dave Ahrens and I'm the co-founder and CEO of Unbundled Attorney. In this podcast, we interview many of our provider attorneys, as well as some of the leading experts in the industry to isolate the best practices for building internet-generated leads and how to ethically and effectively offer unbundled legal services and other more affordable options in your practice. For more information about our services, visit www.unbundledattorney.com. All right, I'm really excited to share this episode with you. This is an interview with Alex Keenan, who's one of our provider attorneys out of Dutchess County, New York, Poughkeepsie. But he also services Albany and the general Albany Metro, and he's working on potentially expanding to handle Syracuse, Rochester, Buffalo, New York, and some other regions as well. So how is that possible? Well, one of the things that Alex has been working really closely with us on and has been executing really effectively on is bringing on contract lawyers in his practice and also developing a streamlined technology-enabled process for intaking, enrolling, acquiring, and then interfacing with his clients. So he's got the full suite. He's got, obviously, our Unbundled Attorney service for lead generation, which we now have an integration with Lexicata for sales and intake management, doing that all electronically with a click of a button, intake forms. And then he's got LawPay, which allows clients to pay his retainer agreement or an automated billing layaway type of option or a payment plan with a click of a button and also sign a retainer agreement with a click of a button. And then he has Clio, which obviously manages his cases once for the ones that he's converted, and he's able to assign individual cases to individual contract lawyers that he works with, at his whim based on what he feels is best for the client. So, it's a beautiful, streamlined process. He's doing almost 100% of enrollments right over the phone, handles all the lead calls himself, and then assigns clients to attorneys based upon their local region so that they always have a local provider attorney, even though he's in Poughkeepsie, an hour and a half, sometimes 3 hours away from Saratoga. He's got a local provider attorney that handles that client for him. So really just the boundaries as far as how far and how wide attorneys can grow a practice fueled by lead generation and then also by enabled by technology are completely being blown away. And so for attorneys that are ambitious and want to expand and have always been limited to the pool of clients that happen to be, an hour and a half from your office, this is a perfect example and an illustration of how this has been made possible. So let's get right into it. This interview with Alex Keenan, again, our provider attorney out of Dutchess County and Albany and soon potentially the entire Rust Belt of New York. All right, Alex, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, man, this is, like I was just saying, this is a long time coming here. We've been talking about having you on the show for a while, but there's been so many things that you've wanted to accomplish in the meantime that we just felt like wanted to find the right timing so that you've executed on so many of your masterful plans. So I'm excited the day has finally come and looking forward to sharing with everyone what you've been able to accomplish in just a few short months of us working together. So thanks for taking the time today.
All right. Sounds good. My pleasure.
Yeah. So, Alex, if you give a little bit of background on maybe your personal background, where you come from, how you got your start in the practice of law and the regions and areas of law that your practice serves now.
All right. Yeah, sure. I'm a lawyer in New York, outside of the city, about an hour north, right up the Hudson River. And I actually went to law school in Florida, and then I did an LLM in maritime law in London. And when I came back to the States, I went and I got my MBA with a focus in maritime. So I'm actually an admiralty lawyer. When I came back to the States, there's not a whole lot of admiralty work, unfortunately. So I opened up my own practice, and shortly thereafter, I found you guys. And which has been a great supplement to the commercial and kind of real estate stuff that I was doing at the time. So at this point, in the few short months we've been working together, family law has kind of taken over my practice, and that's kind of our focus at this point.
Hmm. What was the initial draw to admiralty law, or did you just grow up on the ocean and had an interest in it, or what was your original thrust in that direction?
I mean, we used to take trips to the beach, which was always awesome. We used to go like once a week down to Long Island, which is about 2.5 hours from where I grew up. And, you know, when I was a teenager, my brother and I got a little boat and we had it out on the river, and it was the best thing ever. It was something like we just discovered it. And, you know, in law school, actually, even before that in college, I started volunteering with the Coast Guard and just kind of got wrapped up into it. And that kind of became my passion in life.
And what does, for those that aren't so familiar, what does Admiralty Law encompass? And what was your initial thinking around, you know, practicing in that area?
So, yeah, it encompasses a whole lot. I mean, anything from criminal law to, you know, contracting, just anything that has to do with the ocean, you can probably find, you know, some form of law that touches Admiralty. But it's just a very old body of law, so it doesn't change a whole lot. And, you know, after I went to school, I was obviously figured out a lot more about it since my law school didn't have any Admiralty courses. And it's a lot of commercial law, basically, you know, international trade. There's these things called charter parties, which is kind of like renting a ship. And there's entire lawyers who just do charter parties. So it's very specialized. So it becomes very complex very quickly.
Okay, and did you say that you got your license to practice law first and then an MBA, or did you do it the other way around?
So I actually took the New York bar during my MBA. It was a year and a half program. I got it in the summer.
And what was the draw for you to take an MBA? That would say that seems probably on the more unusual side for attorneys. They focus on the practice of law, but don't necessarily have the background in business and business administration. So how did that that combination, how has that helped in building out your practice so far?
So I initially did it because when I went to London and did the LLM, a lot of my classmates had already been, you know, working in Admiralty law firms or for shipping companies, and they had a business background. They did that first. So I was kind of behind a little bit. I had to catch up on the maritime business side of things. So when I came back, I went to SUNY Maritime, which is in the Bronx, and it was kind of a specialist MBA. And just because Admiralty law is so commercial, they kind of actually play off pretty well. Luckily, though, the principles readily transfer between, you know, maritime business and a law practice business. Just keeping track of my ROI and things like that, they don't teach you that in law school. So it's actually come in pretty handy.
Mm. Okay. And so you, and out of law school, you started pretty much, how long was it when you graduated law school that you started your own practice?
Okay. So that would have been, we're looking at, I graduated in 2013 and I started in January 2017. So 3.5 years.
Okay. And did you work for a firm in between, or what was the transition period between when you graduated and then decided to start your solo practice?
So I graduated from the MBA. I had my law license and I went right into solo practice.
Oh, wow. Okay. That was what I thought. Yeah. It seemed like there was not much time between when you graduated and you just said, you know what, I'm going all in.
Right. And that's the kind of, I had spent the 6 months between getting my law license and graduating, you know, looking at the Admiralty market, and it just wasn't there. So shortly before graduation, I made the decision we're going to go solo.
Hmm. And what was it for you that gave you the confidence or had you so convicted in going the direction of being a solo practitioner and starting your own practice in today's age right off the bat?
I had looked into it briefly, I guess summer second year in law school with a friend, and we had considered, you know, well, let's graduate and open up a practice, just the two of us, and we'll kill it. You know, we looked into it pretty seriously, but it just never came to fruition. We were just, I think, a little immature at the time. But then, you know, after I had these other two degrees on top of that, and I'm very confident with the computer and all that goes with it, I said, well, I can do this. And, you know, one day I kind of started designing the logo and I thought, well, you know, this will give me the flexibility to do the kind of cases that I want to do. I can pick and choose the clients, pick and choose the areas of law I want to practice in. Sounded pretty good.
Okay. So let's maybe jump right into the kind of genesis story of our relationship and how things started kind of growing pretty rapidly. I mean, the Hudson River is a relatively small population area compared to, for example, New York City or Albany. And so your primary office or your headquarters is Poughkeepsie, correct?
Yeah, it's Poughkeepsie. So it's about an hour and a half south of Albany.
Okay, so maybe you could walk us through how we initially started. If I recall, you had started, you know, handling not only your own region, but also another region, you know, Albany, which was about an hour and a half north of you, correct?
Right. So I actually found you guys through LawPay. I started researching them because I wanted to accept credit cards and was worried about the whole trust account versus operating account, you know, the ethical issues with that. And you guys popped up, so I got in touch with Graham. And we started talking about, you know, the region where I was living, the Hudson River Valley. And you're right, it's just not super populous. So he kind of said, well, what about doing like a satellite office, a day office or something in Albany? And so I said, okay. So we started with the Hudson River Valley. I did a little research in Albany, and I found an executive suite. And they set me up with a day office, which I just paid for by the hour. And then I called you guys back, set up Albany, and it kind of took off from there.
Okay. And that was like, was it Regis or it was a virtual office where you could, you know, reserve time by the hour?
It's like a virtual, it's kind of like Regis. It's not, it's, they're a private company. As far as I know, they're only in Albany, but, yeah, they had this, this floor of a skyscraper and, they just rented out by the hour.
And how has that been helpful for you in, you know, starting a practice in a new region to have the virtual office to bridge the gap?
Well, it's definitely helpful because actually that's a different area code as well. So I kind of, you know, you need something for the clients to trust you and that you're not some faraway guy who's just, you know, going to take their money and disappear overnight. So, you know, we set up a new phone number with the right area code. We had an address in Albany now. And, you know, for me, it was just, okay, well, I've got 7 leads who, you know, came through and want a consultation. Let's get them all scheduled, you know, one right after the other on a Thursday. And I'll drive up to Albany and I'll meet with them all. And that's fine. That paid for itself. That was great.
So from your first batch of leads in Albany, you got a number of appointments and just booked them all. You batched the appointments per se to one day so you could optimize the travel time in order to meet with the clients up at Albany?
Exactly. As much as I could, I would batch them together. You know, sometimes you wouldn't have a full day, so you'd try to batch them in the afternoons, and that way, you know, you're not traveling as much and you're not paying the hourly rate to wait for clients to show up. If they're all in the afternoon, you can just do one right after the other.
And just for those that are curious and interested in doing the same, how was it that you'd set up the local phone number? Did you use Google Voice for that, or how did you get a local phone number? Because that is something that some clients have concerns about. If they see a number from outside the region, they automatically assume, well, this person's not local, and it raises issues of trust. So how did you get that local number set up so that when you were calling clients or they were calling you, it was the, you know, 518 area code?
Right. So originally I did it actually through the office. They had a service where they could actually, the clients would call the receptionist at the office. The receptionist would forward it to me. However, I don't do that anymore. Right now I have, I switched finally over to Vonage, and I have 2 numbers. They both come right to my phone. One's a Albany area code. One's a Poughkeepsie area code.
Okay. So you have the 518 Vonage phone number, and that Vonage number just rolls over to your Poughkeepsie phone number, whether it be a cell or a home office line?
Right. So it's just my normal main line, the 845 number, and the 518 is pretty much just forwarded right to. So no matter who calls, I answer the same way.
And do you show the 518 number on your profile page? In other words, do you use the most popular number on the profile page, or do you use your primary office line?
So I use my primary office line. However, I will sometimes call people back from the 518 number if I know they're pretty far upstate. Because we've expanded from Albany into, you know, Saratoga, which is another 45, 50 minutes away. So, you know, the farther out they are, I'll call from the 518. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's Vonage. That's a Vonage box you're using through Voice over Internet, or do you have the Vonage Extensions app on your phone? How have you been using that so far?
So I've got a desk phone here that's, plugged into my Ethernet. I also have the app on the phone. So, you know, when I'm on the road or something, I can make it look like I'm calling from the office. But yeah, it syncs up with Clio as well. So anytime I'm talking to a client or something like that, it's actually recording the time and, you know, puts it directly into Clio. So I don't have to kind of cut down on the recording time.
Oh, that's right. I didn't know that. It's a good reminder that Vonage has that integration. So it basically tracks the length of each call. And so if you're doing, you know, billable time over the phone, or you just want to keep track of how, you know, how long you've been spending on each call with each client, it basically makes a record for each Clio, matter you have in Clio. It's synced up.
Right. So like, you know, you put in the client's information, or they give you their information, their phone number, in Clio. So whenever you call that number or they call you from that number, Clio recognizes it and starts recording the time. And then it gives you the option to, you know, add a note to it or something like that. It also records whether it's inbound or outbound, the time, just useful stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Awesome. This kind of does it automatically, you know, and I'll make a note about Vonage. We've been using Vonage in our company for a very long time. What's really useful with Vonage, especially for those that might want to travel internationally, is anytime you call from Vonage, like you said, you can have your Vonage extensions app, which basically just, you know, makes calls through either your, you know, 4G LTE connection on your phone, or you can make calls through Wi-Fi, assuming your phone is connected to Wi-Fi. And you can be making calls from Italy or from, you know, Croatia or South America or wherever you are on vacation, and the phone number will still say your local office line, your 518 number. And then any clients that want to call you to your office line, if you have that set up as your office line, even if you're in Italy or Hawaii or Croatia or South America and they call that number, it rings right to your phone. It's a local call for the client and rings your phone wherever you are internationally.
That's a nice selling feature.
Yeah. Yeah. And so from a location independence for, you know, cultivating worldwide travel, for being able to take a vacation, and if you wanted to still work remotely, we have a lot of attorneys, and I'll just plant the seed, we have a lot of attorneys that spend a lot of time, they focus their time on fielding the lead calls and doing a lot of virtual work. And then they have, you know, contractors, which we're going to get into in just a minute, that make a lot of the appearances in court and do the in-person time. It starts when you start to look at how Vonage can allow you to work remotely in such a way and internationally without even appearing like you're outside of Albany. It starts to get the wheels turning on ways in which you can even practice remotely part-time out of the year, for example.
Right. Yeah, that's awesome.
Why not, huh?
Yeah. Makes taking a vacation that much easier.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you could even keep the practice running without skipping a beat from a beach in Brazil, I think that might entice some, that might be an interesting idea or interesting experiment for some attorneys. I don't know if that would have been possible 5-10 years ago.
Oh, right. Absolutely.
Okay, so let's switch gears here. So you started out, you were making the trip up to Albany. You were, you know, 100% solo practice. And I think, you know, to some degree, you're still solo. But at one stage, you started getting to the point where you wanted to hire, you know, some help, you know, hire contract lawyers to start supporting you in, you know, working with these clients in Albany. And, you know, obviously, you were working on some other regions as well. So walk us through that process. At what point you decided to start making the transition to hiring a contract lawyer to assist you, and take us through how that's gone so far?
Yeah. So batching clients into, you know, a certain afternoon or a certain day is not too bad. Batching court appearances does not work though. So basically I would be driving to Saratoga, which is about 3 hours away from me, and for, you know, an hour court appearance. So I'd spend 6 hours in the car and only get to bill for an hour, which the economics just don't work out after a while. So, you know, I was talking with Graham about this and I listened to the podcast and how some other people had done it. And I wound up putting an ad on Craigslist and an ad on Indeed. It cost about, I think, $75 for both. And I got plenty of responses. You know, I had asked for somebody who was experienced in family law, and I got the gamut of people who had zero experience, people who have been doing it for 20 years. I wound up hiring a great guy who, you know, had worked in the area for other family attorneys, and he was like in transition. So this was a great like temporary gig for him. And it worked out so well that now I'm up to a total of 3 contract attorneys all over the regions that I handle.
Okay. What was the best source of inquiries of lawyers? Was it Craigslist, Indeed? Was it just kind of an even combination? What did you find when you were posting ads for contract lawyers?
So I posted the exact same ad on both sites. Indeed got me the most responses. However, I hired all three, I believe, from Craigslist.
Hmm.
So yeah, it's weird. They're more what I was looking for.
They seem to be more aligned to the type of work you were looking for. Can you compare, contrast the two, or isolate why that was different for you?
You know, I'm not really sure. I asked for an experienced family attorney, somebody with at least a year of experience in family law. And I got a lot of new graduates from the Indeeds, and I got people who had experience in other kinds of law. Which wouldn't have been so bad. I'd have to do a little training, but at least I would have had courtroom experience. Whereas with Craigslist, I got people, I mean, the three attorneys I have now all have at least a year of experience in family law. The first guy I hired had 20 years of experience in family law, so he was perfect. And I'm not sure why that's the case. Indeed claims to have a good algorithm for that. But I'm not sure why that popped up that way.
Okay. And can you walk us through how you structured the relationship with the contract lawyers? And then maybe we can start diving into, your workflow as far as calling the leads and then reassigning and so forth. But what does the relationship look like from a financial standpoint? Is there, is an hourly split, or how does that work? And how did you kind of initially create those relationships? Maybe you can walk us through that.
Sure. So financially speaking, it's an even split at this point. I try to keep them as local as possible. So if I have a case in Saratoga, I try to give it to the attorney who lives closest to Saratoga. At this point, I kind of let them run their own sub practice, I guess is how I would call it. We do like a weekly or biweekly check-in where, we check in on the client's trust account and make sure that, that I have money to pay them essentially. Has the client's case progressed? Has it closed? Just status update. And then, but for the most part, once I've gained the client's trust, they kind of take over from there. And they are in charge of the client, with the exception of anything billing related, which I still handle.
Okay. And so you even split, that means on the hourly rate. So what's your hourly rate that you typically bill, and what's the split? Is it I think it was 250 and then 125, 125?
So the hourly rate is 200 and we're splitting it 100-100.
Okay. And so so just for clarification for attorneys that are new to this, the billable rate for the attorney, on the books for the client is $200 an hour. And then because they're a contractor of yours, you get $100 each hour that's billed by the contract lawyer, and then the contract lawyer gets $100 an hour. Is that right?
Right. That's right.
Okay, great. And did you have an independent contractor relationship between you and the contract lawyer? And if so, how did you put that together? Is there a resource online you can suggest for putting together an initial agreement with the contract lawyer?
So I did put, I definitely want to keep it as an independent contractor because I'm not set up to do payroll and whatnot. So I have it set up where they're required to send me an invoice, and that's how I bill the client, and that's also how they get paid. I did formalize that with everybody but the exception of the first contract lawyer I hired. I found a couple of things online and kind of cobbled together a new contract. Which actually I can send you guys if you want. I don't mind if you have other attorneys who are interested in using it. But it's, it's quick and easy. It's three pages. It basically says, hey, you're an independent contractor. You're responsible for, the everyday expenses, your phone bill, whatever. These are the things that we can charge the client for. These are things that you're responsible for. You're required to send me an invoice and to check in with me every now and again to make sure that, we're not doing too much work for the client that they're not going to be able to pay for. Because if we get to that point, then I need to make sure I'm in touch with the client and following up with that money. And that's basically all it says.
Okay, fair enough. And when you were initially bringing on each of these contract lawyers, obviously, we have a very unique type of service relative to, say, most attorneys and what they might be familiar with, such as, obviously offering unbundled legal services, providing payment plans and more structured pay-as-you-go types of options. So we can maybe talk about the options you offer, but Was there some initial, when we start there, what types of options do you find? Like, because you still take some leads and handle the cases yourself, right? You don't always have a contract lawyer take it over.
Right. So for family law right now, I think I have 3 or 4 open cases. I'm going to court this week for one. But basically, I take the ones that are closer to me, you know, because all my contract lawyers, nobody's in the same county as me. So if I get a case that's in the county where I am, I usually take it. Otherwise, I'll hand it off.
Okay. And can you talk about, let's see, well, I mean, we want to get into the types of options that you offer, but one of the things I want to touch on is just your initial training and vetting and working with the attorneys, and just how that went for you, and ensuring that they are offering the types of options that, you know, you're committed to offering. So what are the types of things that you do for your clients? Is it, do you offer some forms of unbundled services? Do you do the payment plans with the clients? Maybe you can do a quick overview of how you've been, you know, obviously very successful at converting clients that you work personally into paying customers. And then we can maybe talk about how you've been able to duplicate that or share that or train that in with the contract lawyers you've worked with so far.
Okay. Yeah, gotcha. So the whole kind of philosophy here that kind of works with you guys is, you know, we're taking on people who are, you know, working families, right? They don't have $5,000 retainers. They have, you know, a few hundred bucks maybe, and they need some help. So, but they're working. So, I mean, we can work with that. We do payment plans, layaway options. I try to keep the retainer as low as I can. And, you know, I kind of play with the retainer as I'm talking with the client and see what they can afford. But, you know, we've occasionally taken $300 for a retainer just to kind of get things going. You know, sometimes we get a call, they have court tomorrow. Well, we'll see what we can do for you. And I've rarely gotten burned on that, so it's not a huge deal. When I go to hire a contractor and we're in the interview, I try to be as open as I can with them that, you know, this may not be your typical experience with family law where the people are asking for $3,500 or $5,000 for a retainer and then kind of hoping for the best. But, you know, we have to have some empathy for these clients. And so that's kind of a big hurdle for me, because I have interviewed people before who just aren't super into that. The people I have working for me now really like that concept. They seem to value, you know, being able to help somebody in their time of need. So that's kind of nice. Those are the people I want to work with who will, you know, kind of buy into the whole premise here. And so there's not a whole lot of training that has to go on, because usually by the time they're meeting the clients, I've already explained to the client what's going on with the payments. I'm still handling the payments for all my contractors. They don't really ever have to follow up with the client on that. I like to keep it separated so they can just concentrate on the legal side of the, on, you know, winning their case, really. And, you know, if I have to, I'll chase the clients down for money.
Okay. Yeah, fair enough. And I mean, did you have a lot of, so you mentioned that you had a lot of attorneys that, you know, were not, you know, and this is probably very similar to, you know, our process for finding attorneys, is that kind of mix between attorneys that want to do things the traditional route and, you know, want to take the upfront retainer. And then there's, you know, kind of a difference in a philosophy, like you said, of attorneys that, you know, really are interested in cultivating empathy and working with clients on a more affordable basis. What's been your experience on identifying, you know, attorneys that want to do both? And what have you found to be the consistent qualities of the attorneys that you've, you know, ended up moving forward with that these attorneys had that made it seem like that you were a good fit to work with them?
So when I initially post the job, I actually put in there, you know, must have empathy for the client, just to give them a heads up that this is something that we're going to discuss either during our initial phone call or at the interview. And then, you know, it does come up. I want to know what experiences they've had where they've had to kind of be flexible on this kind of thing. I also want to know, at their last job, you know, doing family law, what was that policy? What did they not like about it? You know, I had one candidate tell me that, you know, we used to charge for organizing the file. You know, once a month we'd go through all the files and the client would get charged for that. I was like, okay, well, you know, we're not going to charge for that because our clients really can't afford that, and we should be keeping our files together anyway. And, you know, if I kind of see their reaction to that, if they're like, oh yeah, no, I totally agree, that's crazy to charge a client for that, great, you move on to the next step. If they're a little more hesitant, you know, you got to wonder why, and you dig a little deeper. The other thing I do is I do the first, so, you know, usually I'll get a lead on the phone and, you know, get them converted and hired. After that, we set up a meeting with the attorneys who are actually going to handle their case. For the first couple of those meetings, I sit in with the new contractor. And that way I can kind of guide the meeting to make sure that we hit all the points and answer all the questions the client has as I would answer them. And then I kind of give some feedback to the contractor afterwards, just so that, you know, there's consistency throughout the firm and that we're not making new policies for each contractor. And that's worked out really well so far.
And for the contract lawyers that haven't worked out, at what point have you found that you've been deciding to go, you know, to say, hey, you know, I don't think this is going to work out? Is it at the interview stage? Have you gotten to the point with a couple of contract lawyers where you sit down with clients and then you're going, well, this guy clearly doesn't have empathy or doesn't seem like he's actually a good fit once I've met with this person? Or, you know, what stage do you kind of get to the point where you're really comfortable with the attorney, and where do you find that if it ain't going to work out, you're going to find out?
Well, so far, knock on wood, I have not had a contractor make it past the interview stage who I didn't wind up hiring. So any contract that I've actually sat down with for a client interview has wound up becoming a contractor for me. So so far, so good on that front.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. So you're pretty clear. You're pretty good at, you know, getting a good sense for whether they're going to be a good fit to work together through the initial phone interview. And once you get through the phone interview, by the time you're meeting with them, you're usually pretty comfortable with the fact that it's going to work out.
Yeah, by the end of the interview, I'm pretty certain that this is going to work out fine. Hmm.
Okay, gotcha. So walk us through, Alex. You know, so far, I want to make sure this is clear. So you still field all the lead calls in every region where they come in, and handle that initial consultation and that conversion. And then, you know, it's a handoff to the client, to the contract lawyers from there. So I'd really like to, you know, get specific on how that works, because there's a lot of attorneys, I think, that are interested in opening up other regions, either because they're in a smaller populous zone and want to get into a bigger metro, or they're already doing one metro and they want to open up another metro, for example, which, you know, we can talk about your goals and what you're working on in New York. But maybe let's walk through, you know, where the leads are coming in. They're obviously all coming into you. And how you handle the initial call, and how you do the handoff from there.
Okay, yeah. So, all the regions, they come to me. They're funneled to me, and I get them by email, by text, and then I get a notification from Lexicata, which is my CRM. And that's actually been invaluable, and we've spoken about that before, and it's great because it links up with all the other programs that I'm using. Essentially, in Lexicata, there's an inbox, and it's got all the leads that are coming in basically in real time. As soon as I get the text message, there it is in Lexicata as well. And I can click on that and see all the same information that I would see if I was on, you know, unbundled site and looking at the lead. So from there, usually if I'm at my desk, there's a button that I can just click, and it connects to my Vonage phone, and I pick up the call, and the person's on the other line. Or it rings, and I have to leave them a voicemail, and you know, then I'll email them and, you know, go through the whole process of getting in contact with that lead initially. From there, if I can get them on the phone or set up a time to get them on the phone, I basically just sit and listen to them for as long as it takes for them to tell me about their case. Some people just say, I need an uncontested divorce. It's like pulling teeth for information. Other people, they think they're on the phone with a therapist maybe, and they just want to tell you their whole life story. And that's fine, because those are the people who usually wind up getting converted. There's something cathartic about being able to just get it out and having somebody listen to them and ask them, you know, the right questions. When they can actually talk to you and you ask the right questions to them, they're the ones who wind up converting. They feel comfortable, I suppose. And I know when I first started with you guys, Graham and I were talking about, you know, spend 15 minutes on the phone with the client. As I've kind of progressed through these last few months, that's changed a bit. I usually wind up spending at least a half hour on the phone with the clients. But the kind of trade-off for that is a lot of them I never have to meet in person. I can actually sign them up right over the phone and have them sign their retainer agreement and their and send me their retainer payment as well.
Yeah, you know, I've found that to be, when we've interviewed attorneys, the attorneys that enroll clients over the phone and do that really effectively, a very common thread has been that they take the approach of spending more time with each client on the initial call, you know, in the 30-minute range as opposed to the 10 to 15 minutes, which is the 10 to 15 minutes is more like, you know, let's touch base, make sure it's a case we can handle, you know, build a little bit of rapport, hear a bit about your situation, and then set up the in-office meeting. You know, that can be done and at a very, very high conversion rate and so forth. But for someone to be able to, you know, do it over the phone, it seems like it really does take a bit of time for the client to feel comfortable with you enough to be pulling the trigger and ready to get started, is it not?
Yeah, exactly. I think there's something about meeting somebody in person where there's just instantly more trust. And when you're on the phone with somebody, you kind of have to get over that hurdle of you're an anonymous person on the other end of a wire. And that just takes a little bit of time and, you know, actively listening to the person who's talking and making sure that you understand what their problem is and showing it.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And so maybe you could just take us briefly, because you've done obviously really well, Alex, with, you know, handling those initial calls really effectively and converting clients consistently. I don't know if you could share, if you know off the top of your head, roughly what your conversion is, you know, out of 10, how many leads roughly you convert out of 10. And of those, how many are usually right over the phone?
I would say out of 10, maybe it's, in the beginning it was low. Now it's gotten higher. Probably on average, like four out of 10 get converted. And I would say at least three or four are done entirely over the phone, which it actually works out well. When I was doing it in the beginning and was, you know, batching clients together, or batching leads at that point, you know, you'd have to schedule them out a week, right, to get it to work effectively. And you'd always get somebody who doesn't show up or who needs to reschedule or something like that, which, you know, again, it just, the economics of it didn't work driving all the way up to Albany to meet with these guys. So doing it over the phone makes things way easier, because even if they're not interested or they don't have the money or something, you can figure that out all right from your desk. And it's so worth the extra time, you know, spending it on the phone versus having to drive to meet these people.
Mm. And so how do you, is there a point in the call where you, I mean, do you just ask the client, you know, one of the ways when you explain the enrollment, we can either do this over the phone, I can do it in the office. Like, how do you isolate or determine whether it's a client that needs, you know, really feels like they need to meet with you in order to feel comfortable with moving forward? Or is someone that would be open and willing to just enroll shit over the phone at that time? Or does the client just tell you?
Oh, they just tell you. They tell you straight up, I want to meet this person before I, you know, commit anything. And that's fine. You know, I kind of respect that. If I was hiring a lawyer, that's probably what I would do. So that's fine. Basically, what we'll do is instead of them coming down to meet me or me going up to meet them, what I usually do is I call up my contractor who is in their, you know, their region. And I say, listen, what does your schedule look like for this week? Can you meet this potential client? I'll send you all the background on them that I have from this phone call. And they're usually, you know, they're totally fine with that, because they're nearby. And I tell the lead that, hey, listen, I'm going to set you up at the meeting with the person who's actually going to be handling your case. And they love that. That's fine. I have them fill out an intake form before that meeting, just so we have all their information. And I send them the retainer agreement and the payment link, which they also appreciate because it gives them time to read about it. And usually I can have them in a meeting with the contractor, you know, that week. So there's less time for them to either think, well, maybe I don't need help, or go hire some other attorney or something like that. And they also see that the retainer agreement's reasonable and we're not trying to pull the wool over their eyes or anything like that. And oftentimes right after the meeting with the contractor, I get a notification from LawPay saying, oh, they've paid their retainer agreement. So it works out fine. Other times, you know, we get to the point in the phone call where we have to discuss, you know, the payment arrangements, which I like to keep to the end once they've told me all about their case. And, you know, I'll tell them, I was like, listen, these are the three things I'm going to send you in an email right after we get off the phone. If you have any questions about them, give me a call. But you can, this is like filling out a intake form at the doctor's office. This is like paying for something on Amazon. You just type in your credit card number and it's good to go. And usually within a half hour of me sending that, I find that they've got, you know, the retainer payment is sitting there in LawPay as well.
Let's just go through that, that initial call, you know, more of this 30-minute type of enrollment call. Are there some things that you do early on in the call just to make sure you have someone that is, you know, among the working families? I mean, do you ask them, are they working? You know, what's your income? Like, or what, or do you have some initial qualifiers? Because, you know, inevitably, you know, as someone that's done a lot of lead calls myself, it can be a bit frustrating if it happens repeatedly over time, and especially, you know, 3, 4, 5 times in a row, for example, which sometimes when you call leads, you know, they go in flows, where you would, you know, spend 20-30 minutes on the phone only to determine that the person has no income whatsoever and doesn't even, you know, have support and really is going to be struggling to come up with, you know, $100. And I love the fact that you actually have an option you offer to that person. And we're going to unpack layaway here in just a minute, but is there, you know, maybe we can start with, is there anything initially that you ask just to have some layer of qualification of the client early on in the call, just to make sure that you have, you know, someone that's, you know, going to be in some form or position to work with you?
Yeah. So usually what I do is, you know, I introduce myself. This is why I'm calling. Do you have a couple minutes to discuss your case? And then what's going on? So it's a very open-ended question. It lets them kind of get out what they've been holding back. And I pretty much just let them go on for 5 minutes. Within that 5 minutes, a lot of times they'll tell me whether they're working or not and what they do. So I don't even have to ask. After the 5 minutes, that's a great question for me to ask them is, okay, so what do you do for a living? You know, especially because we're talking about, you know, usually it's visitation time or custody. They're perfectly willing to tell me exactly what they do and how much they make. They're willing to tell me what their ex-spouse, you know, does and what they make. You know, so they're not usually very defensive about that at that point. You know, even if they're not working, a lot of times what I've found is they've got a relative who's willing to help them out. Or just this week I had somebody who said, oh, my aunt's going to give me a break on the rent, so I'll be able to pay your retainer. Oh, okay, great. You know, I mean, however you make it work. And at the end of the call, that's kind of how I frame it to them is that, you know, look, we're not looking to put you into the poorhouse. We're very flexible about it. But at the end of the day, you know, we're doing some work for you. So we need to get paid for it. And I would say 9.5 times out of 10, they go, oh, no, I totally get that. I'm the same way. I, you know, drive a truck. I expect to get paid too. Not a big deal. And they figure out a way to do it. And they really appreciate the fact that we're flexible in how we get paid.
Okay, great. So even if you have someone that maybe doesn't have an income, you kind of just note it as, you know, you kind of make a mental note of that. Okay, you know, that's going to be something we'll have to work out later on. But you still will spend the time, the 20-30 minutes or so, you know, getting into the details of their situation and letting them, you know, vent about their problem, regardless, correct?
Yeah, for the most part. I'm more looking for how reasonable this person is. You know, occasionally I'll get a call where they, you know, want to get the judge to recuse himself and they're going to appeal to the Supreme Court and just kind of crazy stuff like that, that, you know, we're not going to take on. And that's more of the filter that I'm there for is to,
right,
you know, initially make sure that it's something we can actually and are willing to help them with. And then after that, kind of get into the whole payment and financial side of things.
You know, I love that, Alex. I love that your filter more has almost exclusively to do with, is this person reasonable? Is what they're trying, something they're trying to do legally able to be done? Is it realistic? And that your filter really doesn't have much to do with their finances at all. I mean, not to say that it is important. It is, and you have to work that out at the end of the game, but at the end of the day, but your options are so flexible that it really, I mean, and maybe you can just share this, you know, from your own personal feelings or experience, it doesn't seem like finances are really an option or really a barrier anymore. So you can just focus on, you know, okay, can we help this person?
And that's just it. I you know, I've gotten burned so few times on, you know, not taking a giant retainer up front. At this point, I know I was just talking with Graham last week about, you know, even offering some more flexibility, flat rates and things like that. It's not such a big deal. You know, if we can help the person, the next step is to figure out, well, can we do it and make a little money on at the same time? But yeah, I mean, it shouldn't be a barrier to decent legal help. And if we can help them, then we will.
Yeah, that's awesome. Okay, so let's fast forward to the end of the call here. And so I want to get into some of the practicality of of how you communicate to the client that you're going to be assigning them to a contract lawyer that you work with in the firm. I don't know if you use the word contract lawyer or, you know, I'm going to be assigning you to this attorney. He's going to be, you know, he's right there in this county. He's going to be helping you. So can you maybe share a bit of the languaging of, okay, so we want to cover two things here. Number one, how you enroll the client and talk about the fees and so forth. And then second of all, how you communicate to them that, you know, that you're going to be assigning them an attorney in their local county that's going to be, you know, so-and-so that's going to be, you know, handling the case from here.
Right. So I don't use the word contract attorney just because I find it creates confusion. Immediately when you say contract attorney, people think of, you know, an actual contract and they want a family law attorney. And so it doesn't really add up for them. And it's something
that makes
else
sense.
To explain.
Right.
So instead what I say is, okay, you're in Saratoga. I live in Dutchess County, which is about 3 hours away. My attorney X, Y, and Z lives in Saratoga. I'm going to assign him to your case. He's free on that day because usually they come with a court date to handle your case. How about we set up a phone call between the two of you? What does your week look like? You know, and that way they can tell me, oh, well, I work from 9 to 6 and, you know, I need a nighttime phone call. Okay, no problem. Something from that. They don't usually question it. Occasionally I'll get somebody who says, oh, okay. Do they have a lot of experience with that kind of thing? And I'll go through and, you know, I know that attorney X, Y, and Z has done family law for this many years and, you know, has been successful with our firm, et cetera, et cetera. But usually I don't get too much of a pushback from it.
Yeah, it kind of makes sense when you say, hey, you know, I'm in Dutchess 2-3 hours away, but, you know, our attorney, you know, so-and-so, handle, you know, he's right there in Saratoga. He'd be a really good fit for you to work with you. That kind of makes sense in the client's mind, right? Like that, you know, they're going to want to work with someone local, and that the fact that you offer someone that is right there in their county or in their local region is something that, you know, they're probably going to want it. That's kind of a benefit to them, is it not?
It is. And I mean, I'm thinking about another time when somebody kind of questioned, well, why aren't you the person who's going to work for me on my case? And I say to them, well, I'd be happy to, but you know, you're this many hours away, and then I'd have to charge you for that travel time. And maybe you can afford that, but I would, you know, this is going to be a much better option for you in terms of, you know, overall financial. And they go, oh yeah, you're right. It's because he's only 20 minutes from the courthouse or whatever. And you know, instantly it's, oh, okay, no problem.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Can you talk about, you know, just your network of contract lawyers? You set up a phone call with a contract lawyer. By that time, have you already enrolled them into your services of your firm? Or just sometimes do you do kind of an introductory call and then the enrollment takes place? Like how does that tend to work?
Usually they're already enrolled. I try to make sure that I've taken care of that before they meet the contractor, because I have to pay the contractor whether or not we've got them enrolled. So ideally I'd like to get them enrolled and, you know, give them their free consultation with me. And then, you know, by the time they go to see the contractor, we're already putting together a plan for this case. We're already doing some real substantial work. Occasionally the client will specifically ask to meet the contract lawyer before they will enroll. And that's fine. I tell them that they get a half hour with the contractor on me. And, I set up the call with the contractor so that they can arrange a time and a place to meet. And that's worked out well so far.
Okay, great. Can you talk about just briefly, you know, your enrollment process is, you know, 100% digital online, or you just take the card over the phone, I would assume, in certain scenarios. But can you talk about how Lexicata, LawPay, Clio, and just having these tools available to you, that I believe you're using all three, has made a lot easier for you to be able to complete that enrollment right over the phone, or, you know, have the client be able to do it from their computer or smartphone with a few clicks of a button.
Yeah, this is really cool. I love the fact that everything I use kind of syncs with each other, and it's kind of something I've built from the time I was, you know, working with nothing back in January. So I started with Clio and LawPay, which work really well together. And again, the LawPay solved the ethical issue of where does the credit card processing fee get pulled from the trusted operating. And then, I use Clio for all of my active and closed cases. So Unbundled has the option to either import the lead into Clio or I use Lexicata as well for my CRM, my customer relations management software. And I have unbundled leads go into Lexicata, and I use that solely to keep track of my pipeline, meaning, you know, what stage is the lead at? Have I called them yet? If I've called them, do they need to follow up? Are they interested? Are they waiting on money? Have they hired? Whatever. I also use Lexicata to do all the paperwork prior to taking on their case. So the intake form is totally automated in Lexicata. I send them out a pre-populated form. I have one for custody disputes. I have one for divorce, and the questions are a little different for each one. And it pulls all that information in once the client has filled it out, and it populates Lexicata and Pleo for me. So their name, their address, their phone number, there's no typing errors. It just all gets done automatically. The other thing I do is I send out the retainer agreements through Lexicata. They're all automated as well. So I have like a standard retainer agreement, and it needs the date filled out, dear client, but it, you know, automatically puts in their name. It allows me to put in the retainer amount, because that varies based on who I'm talking to, and then allows me to sign it electronically. At that point, I can send it out to the client or clients. It does multiple clients too, and they can sign it electronically either from their computer or their smartphone, and it gets sent back to me and it's timestamped. So I have that. And then once that's done, I mark them as hired in Lexicata, and I export the whole thing to Clio, and it automatically creates a new matter. All of their information, like their name and address, is there. All of their notes that I've taken while I've been on phone calls with them become notes in Clio, and their intake form and retainer agreement also transfer over. So now I've got a ready-to-go matter in Clio, which I can then share with the contractor, or if it's a case I'm keeping, you know, I have it for me. And, you know, from that point, we're good to go. The other side of it is the law pay side of it with recurring payments and whatnot. I have clients, I send them a link from LawPay so they can make their initial retainer agreement, initial retainer payment, excuse me. And then I have a form that goes out to them in Lexicata, which they can also sign electronically if they want, if they're on a recurring payment plan. And, from there, I just upload that into LawPay, and they get charged on a regular basis. I let them choose. I tell them this is, you know, kind of how much it's going to be per month. If you get paid weekly, cool, let's do it weekly. If you get paid biweekly, fine, let's do it biweekly. And that makes them feel good that they have some choice over what day they get billed. And then, you know, everything in LawPay that comes in gets recorded in Clio, so I can keep track of who's got what kind of money in the trust account.
Wow. Yeah, and can you just talk about how having all these, or at least you share for yourself and your own experience, having all these systems integrated and also being able to interface with the client electronically, you know, from their smartphone and so forth, has impacted your practice and just your ability to, you know, do everything you do virtually?
Well, I'd say the one word that comes to mind is it's just streamlined things. Having everything integrated is huge, because I have the client really doing a lot of the work. The intake form, you know, I don't ever have to write down what their address is or their spouse's name or anything like that. They're filling it out because they're the most familiar with it. And that information stays from the time that they're a lead all the way until their case is closed. And it's the information they provide it. And it seamlessly just bounces from one program to another and stays with the file. Paper files, I still have to keep them because, you know, the court likes to fax things or whatnot. But for the most part, I can get all of the client's information at home on a laptop or even on my phone. I can instantly share it with the contractors. Clio has this Clio Connect, which is kind of like a private cloud, I guess. And it, you know, lets me show both the client and the contractor the entire file, what we got going on. I can send bills to the client. I can send trust requests to the client. If you know, their account's low, I just let them know and I send them out a link and they take care of the payment. I don't have to take it over the phone or anything like that. They're doing it on their schedule. It just it cuts down the time really that I have to spend doing the more menial tasks.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. And from the contract standpoint, In Clio, are you assigning the client to that specific contractor in Clio so that then that contractor gets access to the file from there?
Exactly. I have a list of matters that are currently open. The new matter comes in from Lexicata. I click on it, and I can actually share that whole file with a particular contractor. They get a link in their email that says, Alexander has opened Clio Connect for this particular matter, and they've got all the documents, all the intake forms, all the notes from the phone calls that I've made. They can see all of that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, to be able to, have each client individually assigned, because that contract lawyer can only see the cases that they have been assigned by you in Clio, correct?
Exactly. Like I don't need my contractors seeing all the other cases or the firm's financials or anything like that. They just get to see the client that they're working on and the relevant documents to that client.
Yeah. I mean, it's really a beautiful thing, Alex, for you to, to have been working with you for the time that we have, helping you get Lexicata set up. And for anyone that wants, access to these templates, as far as the emails that go out, each of these emails are pre-written and are templates in Lexicata. And so, like you said, you update, bi-weekly or weekly for the payment, maybe update their name and then click a button and send. It makes, all these forms already pre-created so that, like you said, it's streamlined. Each step in the process is available. And so we have these forms, these template emails in, and maybe Alex, I should work with you a little bit more on, getting the recurring agreements or some of these things together, if you'd be open to it, so that attorneys can start to utilize some of the more aspects of this streamline to be able to, again, just want every step of the process isn't being duplicated. The client's completing the intake themselves. You don't have to do that yourself. It auto-populates and translates directly from Lexicata to Clio right into the documents. Are you using any form of document automation software on the back end to help with getting some initial paperwork done if you're the one to do the case or you haven't gotten that to that point yet?
Not necessarily document automation. I do use some cloud services. So I have Microsoft OneDrive and Google Cloud, or Google Drive, I think they're calling it now. So that, I have some templates and things that I share with the contractors, letterhead, things like that. So everybody's on the same page and it looks uniform. But we haven't necessarily explored the automation with the documentation yet. But I could see that coming within the next few months.
Okay, great. Yeah, and we're also, by the way, for those attorneys that are interested in asking questions about individual episodes, we're going to start launching a blog post on our website, unbundledattorney.com/blog, or you just click on the blog. And we're going to launch entire transcriptions of each episode, and then there'll be places where you can leave comments, ask questions, which either we can respond or, Alex, I'll give you the opportunity to respond to any questions as well, if you'd be open to doing that.
Yeah, definitely.
And, that awesome. And so that, attorneys that are curious about this stuff or want more clarification on how it works, we can also put some links to, some of the documents and templates that we put together and give you more of a medium in order to interact both with, Unbundled Attorney, us, Alex, and get some more additional support or suggestions on some of the things that we're talking about here. So that's going to be coming here by the time this episode is launched. We should have the blog ready to go. So final thing here, Alex, I'd love to touch on is just, obviously you're working virtually from, a small town, smaller town in New York. You've got, three contract lawyers surrounding Albany, New York. You're working almost 100% virtually, working, enrolling clients over, over the phone virtually. You've got streamlined online intake systems. You've got a phone system that you could work for the Bahamas if you wanted to. What are some of your goals? Or maybe you could share a little bit of your vision for what you think is possible with your expansion and growth over the months and years to come throughout New York or whatever it might be.
Well, yeah, I mean, ideally we'd move from one metropolitan area, in our case Albany, and get the next adjacent one, just kind of grow across New York. I think New York City is its own separate entity, but there are other metropolitan areas in New York, Syracuse, Rochester, even Buffalo is out there, which I think would be great for the system. And I think it's partly, in the immediate future, is getting the system tightened up to where it's just you know, it works no matter who's in control of it. And maybe that means I have to hire a paralegal or somebody to help me make calls in real time when I'm in court or something like that. But I think for the years to come, the certainly it's about growth and adding some more areas and kind of building out that way. If you can do it virtually, why not?
Yeah, I mean, it really takes away all the barriers that used to limit attorneys in their ability to, you know, handle a very specific pool of clients, which is, you know, clients that just happen to reside within 1 hour of your office. As soon as it starts to get beyond that, then you start to run into logistical challenges or, you know, economic challenges of just the sheer travel time, like you mentioned early in the episode, of, you know, having to travel, you know, 4 to 6 hours for one, you know, hour of time. So, right. You know, that really starts to make a huge difference in just the long-term potential. Hang on one second.
Sure.
So that really starts to make a, you know, huge difference in long-term growth potential of attorneys and firms that are ambitious. For attorneys that want to expand, that want to grow, that want to, you know, open up new offices and be able to reach into pools of clients and growth that otherwise was impossible. They didn't have the ability to work virtually, do enrollments, do these contract lawyers. So, you know, it's really exciting to me, you know, because I, you know, as a company, I'm 100% supportive of you, Alex, you know, attorneys like yourself that, you know, are offering such affordable services. And one thing we didn't get a chance to talk about is layaway. Maybe we can hit that really briefly at the very end here. But, you know, such affordable services, a very fair hourly rate. You know, clients are really happy. You're obviously being extremely flexible with the retainer agreement. Your conversion rate, you know, shows that you're able to help 4 out of every 10 of clients that we're sending you at least. And I'm sure you're continuing to work on improving that. And there's always potential for growth and improvement on those levels. And, you know, that we're 100% supportive of you being able to build, you know, your organization within an organization, you know, because we know that, you know, at the helm, you know, your philosophy is right. You're committed to serving these clients in the best way possible and the most affordably as possible. So, you know, I would love to support you in continuing to grow your practice and your reach and the amount of clients that you can serve as far as you like to grow it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you guys have been incredibly supportive. Even just these podcasts, you know, are they've a wealth of great ideas that I've been able to incorporate. And Graham has been super helpful as well. And but yeah, if you wanted to hit me the layaway works really great for clients who are coming to you and they want to institute a case. They want to bring a case because you kind of have more time with them. You can set up, okay, let's bring your case 3 months from now, and between now and then, let's, you know, set up a payment plan kind of prior to us working. And what I do is on their first payment, let's say it's $100, I will reserve a date for them, you know, and an attorney who can help them. Once we've reached that threshold of whatever the retainer is, then we actually start doing substantial work on the case. And that's worked for a few clients who, you know, have had time, and they've been really appreciative of it.
Yeah, and so you said for petitioning clients that don't have a deadline coming up, if you, let's say it's going to take $1,000 or $1,500 for the work you need to get done for them, even if they only have $100 in their pocket, you know, they can actually start investing and putting and making payments, whether it be $100 a week, $100 a month, you know, $100 every 2 weeks, towards, and all that money goes into the trust account, and they're kind of working towards the balance, right?
Exactly. And I mean, for clients who aren't petitioners, so they're respondents, we've done it where, okay, well, you've got 500 now, that's fine. Why don't you give us the 500 now? We'll get the things together that we need to get together, and then the next 500 will be due before we walk into court with you. And that's worked out really well too. They still reached their $1,000 retainer. We're certain that we're going to get paid. They get somebody to go with them into court, and you know, they're not $1,000 out of pocket right then and there.
Yeah, exactly. So you have to have a little bit more of a barrier. You know, there's a difference in how you have to offer layaway for clients that are responding versus petition, because they just don't have as much time to make the payments towards the threshold, right?
Exactly.
You know, so it's important, I think, that attorneys hear that, you know, there's still barriers, there's still boundaries for the types of options you offer. Layaway is really great, but they need to have some time to make the payments, because, you know, obviously you don't want to get really far behind in doing work for a client and them having, you know, not paid you, right? I mean, and I know you said that you haven't been burned that much, but that's just common sense of running a practice, is just making sure that, you know, you're keeping your billables up to date, right? And so, you know, you wouldn't lay away a $2,500 contested, you know, huge case, you know, from day one that needs to be filed next week, right?
Exactly. And that's the thing. Like I said, you can work with the initial retainer amount as well. You know, if it's something huge and it's going to be next week, well, the retainer amount's probably going to have to be a little bit higher because it's going to require more initial work. If it's something simpler, well, then I don't mind taking a smaller retainer.
Yeah. Or if it's, you know, simpler or complex, if they have more time to make payments towards the retainer on a layaway model, or whether it be a threshold or a payment plan, it gives them, you know, it can give you the buffer regardless. And for the client, it gives them a little bit of structure so they know they're moving forward and making payments towards getting their case done, as opposed to just saying, hey, okay, well, once you have this money together, give me a call.
Absolutely. And it keeps them, you know, with you. They're not spending that 4 months between now and their case looking for somebody else who's going to do it, you know, slightly cheaper or for some other reason. They've committed to you, you've committed to them, and it's just a matter of, you know, them making the payments on time.
Exactly. All right. Well, Alex, thank you so much again for coming on the show and sharing the, you know, the systems that you've developed and we've also developed together, you know, working with Lexicata. And it's really, really a great feeling to just hear about how the whole streamline of, you know, I'm an attorney, the lead generation, posting into Lexicata, the sales CRM, you know, really automating and streamlining your intake process and your retainer agreements. And then you've got LawPay powering the ease and flexibility. You've been able to have them, you know, click a button to make a payment, click a button to set up their automatic recurring billing. And then you've got Clio to manage the cases and assign accordingly to contract lawyers. And, you know, so that, you know, contract lawyers are only seeing the cases that they're actually being, have been assigned to them. And I appreciate you breaking down that process. So it really is, it's a beautiful thing. And I can't be more excited about your future as far as, you know, the growth of your firm. You know, like I said, we're really, you know, on board with supporting you and growing it as far and as wide in New York that you feel confident, and really looking forward to the coming months and years of working together. So thanks again for being willing to come on and share.
My pleasure. Looking forward to what comes next.
All right. Awesome. So with that, we'll go ahead and wrap up. For those of you that are listening, I really appreciate you coming on and listening to these episodes and, you know, constantly honing your craft, improving your practice, finding more affordable ways, more creative ways to work with clients. That's how we close the access to justice gap, you know, and you're an active member in that process, one client at a time, one piece of technology at a time, one new option or adaptation to the way you're working with your clients. So I appreciate you for that, and we will see you all on the next episode. For more information about how our lead generation services can help you grow your practice, visit our website at www.unbundledattorney.com. And if you're enjoying this podcast, please be sure to subscribe so you get each new episode as soon as it's available, and leave us a rating and a review on iTunes. Once again, thanks for listening.